Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
This podcast is part of the Acast Creator Network. Hello and welcome to Cunning Cast with me, Tony Robinson. Last year, the iconic comedy show Blackadder turned 40. It's the show I made my name on, playing the turnip-brained Baldric. And to mark the occasion, I made a TV show in which I tracked down the lost Blackadder pilot. The TV show is called Blackadder the Lost Pilot, and it's available to watch on Sky, Virgin and Now. I did a lot of interviews for it with some of my favourite mates, all of whom gave me interviews which lasted about an hour, and it being television, they only used about 3 minutes. And today, you are going to hear my unedited chat with David Mitchell, who's a comedy genius and a self-confessed Blackadder superfan. David has had a stellar career in British comedy. His big breakthrough was Peep Show with Robert Webb and Olivia Colman. And since then, he's worked on a plethora of panel shows, including Would I Lie to You, Mock the Week and QI. More recently, he starred as William Shakespeare in Upstart Crow, a historical comedy, sound familiar, devised by none other than Blackadder's co-writer, the great comedian Ben Elton.
I was so lucky to be in Peep Show, but then Ben Elton wrote essentially as close a show to Blackadder as you could imagine happening in the 21st century for me to play Shakespeare in. I certainly do not deserve a lottery win after that. I am out of luck.
Oh, and he's just written a book about England's kings and queens called Unruly. Anyway, Melissa, my producer, is here to chat about my interview with David. Hi, Melissa.
Hi, Tony. Well, David, it's a brilliant interview. David is, he's turning quite quickly into a national treasure, isn't he? One national treasure to another, Tony.
It is funny, the way his career has rocketed. Of course, he wasn't in Blackadder. He was a boy when Blackadder happened, and he talked delightfully about how, as a teenager, he knew all the various bits of Blackadder and could recite them. But we wanted someone in who was of a slightly different generation, who could view Blackadder through a different prism. Not someone who was, as it were, emotionally invested in it, but another craftsman who could analyse it and tell us what he thought about it. And that's why we did the interview. Although at the same time, I hardly knew him. I think I'd only ever met him twice. And even on those two occasions, there were other people around, so we didn't say much to each other. But I've always been a bit of a fanboy of his, and apparently he feels the same. And so we just sat down in a chair and talked about stuff not only that we'd never said to each other before, but we both agreed afterwards it were things we hadn't really articulated much before. So we both found it enormous fun.
You're putting your historian's hat on and you're really trying to find out something about the origins of British comedy. And in this case, it's Peep Show. There's absolutely amazing facts coming through and thoughts about how he got together with Robert Webb and their meeting Olivia Colman. And it's sort of like history in the making. It's so fascinating, isn't it?
Also, it's intriguing to know who's worked with who. And virtually all of us have worked with the others at some time. And to see how that meshes, I think a lot of people will find very fascinating.
A comedy family tree, the mind boggles. I mean, I think they're also of this generation, certainly your Blackadder generation and maybe David's, there's also this meeting at university. Sometimes it's Oxbridge in the old days, you know, the comedy circuit, the Footlights Review. You know, a lot of comedic relationships are born from that.
Yes, that's true. I don't think it's quite so true now, although it does happen to some extent. But to hear how that worked, I find interesting because I wasn't part of that coterie.
And do tell us, so this interview, just to remind our listeners, was recorded for television. It was for your TV show, The Lost Pilot. You can, as you've told us, watch it on Sky, Virgin and Now, right now. It's really worth watching. Tell us where, I wasn't there. I'm very sad that I wasn't. But tell us where you met David and, paint a picture for us.
He just came in the room and it was David Mitchell. We were at Television Centre. We tried to do a lot of our interviews at Telecentre just because that's where the original Blackadders were shot. It's totally different now. It all looks very posh and glam. And you can't recognise the room that you're sitting in as anything to do with the place that you were in 40 years ago. But there's something particularly about the exterior that has the same texture, the same feeling about it. And I don't know what I was doing. I just fiddling around in the room, and I suddenly turned around and there was this guy who I respect so much and had hardly ever seen in my life before. It was a bit like the cowboy coming into town.
Oh, that's so sweet. It's one fan to another. I love that. What a thoughtful, fantastic image. Let's hear from you and David that day.
When you were a little boy, how did you watch television? Where would you sit? What would you eat?
I think I'd watch it. We had one telly for most of my childhood, and it would be in the living room. At some point, we got another TV that went in the kitchen, but that was sort of quite late on through my childhood. We had one TV. I remember it as not having a remote control for much of the time, which obviously was great for broadcasters because, you know, you don't have to be so good if people have to get up to stop you. And yes, it would, that would be the focus of every evening, would be being in that room until I was made to go to bed.
Were you allowed to watch anything you wanted?
I think so, but I was quite sort of suggestible. So I think my parents used the technique of saying, oh, I don't think that's a very nice thing, and that would genuinely put me off it. So it was mainly just 9 o'clock bedtime is what I remember.
What were the children's programmes you remember?
Rent a Ghost, and I remember Blue Peter sort of always being on in a way that was slightly comforting, but also you'd rather it was Rent a Ghost. And I remember watching Play School much longer than I should have done and being nostalgic for when it wasn't too young for me.
You know? You're a nostalgic 10-year-old.
Oh, absolutely. So I realised some of the magic's gone, you know, that. I remember the Box of Delights.
Oh, yeah.
That was, and I've watched that as an adult. And
does it still work?
Yeah, it does. The first episode is still haunting. The much vaunted special effects haven't quite stood the test of time. they just look like, you know, some video that someone's done a drawing on. But I remember very fondly remember Knight Rider, which wasn't, I don't know if it was a children's programme, I can't imagine.
No, I don't
it.
Think so.
Yeah. Watched that religiously, and that I've also seen as an adult, and that really has not stood the test of time. That is drivel.
What about any of that wacky Saturday morning television?
I think I watched Swap Shop. I didn't watch Tiz Was. I think that was...
Because it was on the other side?
Yeah, I don't know. I wasn't really it was something when I was a student. I realised I would have been cooler if I'd watched Tiz Was, but I didn't. I watched Swap Shop, and I think. But what I mainly remember about television is if it was on, things were going well for you. That was the aim, was to have the television on, and there were some things that were obviously, you know, I remember Saturday nights. They'd sometimes put a circus on in the summer, and that really wasn't great television, but nevertheless it was than not watching television.
I was exactly the same. I would just whatever was on, you would just absorb it.
Yes.
Became part of you.
Yeah.
Is it any good? Someone might say, yeah. I don't know.
And obviously there were times when you turned the tele and there wasn't literally anything on. It was the test card. And that obviously hugely elevates the value of television when it's not always available.
Yeah. So a bit later on, you are now a student.
Yes.
And you're watching comedy, presumably.
Yeah.
Was it hip comedy that you were watching first of all, or would you watch the old favourites?
I feel my whole life I've caught up on things a bit late. So, but I think when I was a student, this would be in the 90s, I was aware of two shows I was aware of coming through in the 90s would be probably Father Ted and The Day Today. Those are sort of the things I was most aware of then.
But yeah. Surely you must have been watching and laughing at other things prior to that, because in a way they both deconstruct the form, don't they?
Edgy. No, totally. And I think growing, the comedy I was watching as a child moving into teenager would be, well, obviously Blackadder, but Monty Python, but also the Two Ronnies, and Yes Minister, and fair amount of Only Fools and Horses, but not religiously. But then there's too much of it. Like, it lowers the value.
You're not allowed to say there's too much Only Fools and Horses. You go to hell if you say
okay,
that.
Okay, so there isn't enough Only Fools and Horses.
You took the same road as Rowan and Richardson. You went off to, was it Oxford or Cambridge?
Cambridge, yeah.
And were you a public school boy prior to that?
Yes. I'd like to say minor public school boy.
It gives you more edge.
Yeah.
Were you lucky to get in, or did you work really, really hard to get in?
I think both. I certainly felt I was, I was self-identified as a SWAT at school, and I cared about exams and worried and wanted to get into Oxford or Cambridge, and it was, a big deal for me that I did. And then I got there and I didn't want to do any more academic work, and I entirely focused on plays and sketches and that kind of thing. And
what did you study?
History, yeah.
So you must have kept an affection for the subject, didn't you?
Oh, yes. No, and I, now that my job is comedy, yeah. I'm much more into history. No, but when I was there, the time when in those days, the good old local education authority was paying for me to go and study history, that's when I couldn't bear it.
Most of the people from Oxford or Cambridge that I've talked to about the making of Blackadder sort of remember a moment when suddenly somebody said, oh, will you be in this society, yeah. or will you play this role? And suddenly your whole life changes. Yeah. Did you have a sort of Road to Damascus moment like that?
Well, I think I auditioned for the Footlights pantomime when I turned up, and in the second audition for that, I met Robert Webb, and that I remember that very clearly, because I remember finding him immediately very funny. He was a year ahead of me, and so he was, even though he was in the audition, he was in the show already. But I remember finding him very funny, but also being slightly scandalised by the fact that he had an earring. And I remember sort of thinking, okay, now this is a place where not everyone is exactly like me, but they're funny in a way that's sort of different, and having a sense of that's really exciting.
Yeah.
And I think having worked with him for so long, I think the key to why we work well together is that we seem different and are similar.
It's funny though to me,
yeah.
because like, so often in your life, you've played this rather serious, very straight boy, scandalised by yeah. things which yeah. we just think of as quite yeah. ordinary. And I've always assumed that sort of deep down you're edgy, probably a heroin user. And,
oh, yeah, sure. Heroin, yeah.
And that you were playing yeah. that. But in yeah. fact, that was who you were. It's just kind of that now, yeah. looking back, you're aware of it.
Yes, I think there's... I've certainly... The most I can lay claim to is being aware of myself, but I'm not something else.
Yeah,
mocking. It is me. I am Mark Corrigan, perhaps a little bit less of an arsehole.
Oh, I'm glad to be.
Yeah, I mean that's. But it's only me saying that, so, yeah. and I would say
maybe
that,
you're not
I?
That self-aware.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So okay, so you've got into the pantomime. What are we playing in the panto?
I played Tom the page boy.
Oh, great part.
Yeah, and it had, and he was a sort of a nerd. He was comedically nerdy, and so I myself,
you leapt into the unknown.
My self-aware way, I think I exaggerated my own tediousness to comic effect.
Yeah, yeah.
And
then?
And then I was sort of in this group of, I did lots of plays as well, but it was just a lovely group of students all who wanted to do as much acting and comedy as, and there was no, I believe there can be, in, you know, there's no division between people doing the sort of serious plays and the comedy. It was sort of one community of people who were obviously slightly bitchy about each other, but broadly all liked having fun in the same way and all were telling themselves maybe this could be a job.
Could be.
Yeah.
Exactly. What serious shows were you in?
I was in The Crucible. I played Reverend Paris in The Crucible. I don't think particularly well, but, you know, I managed not to get laughs, which I think was important.
But was he slightly nerdy and full of self-doubt?
Oh, he was full of self-loathing and sort of going along with the sort of horrendous consensus that involved murdering women. Yes. So, again, I hope I'm, you know, a bit nicer. But, yeah, that sort of guy.
What else?
You know, I was in Much Ado About Nothing. I was in Death of a Salesman.
Oh, were you?
Yeah.
Can't get away with much in that, can
no,
you?
No, that was, yeah. I did that before The Footlights Panther. I think those are the main, most serious ones.
Did it affect your academic life? Were you doing so much acting that everything else was ignored, or did you stay writing your essays?
No, I was. Yes, I didn't write my essays at all, but I managed not to get thrown out, yeah. But I did the absolute minimum. But
what sort of degree did you get at the end?
I got a 2-2.
Oh, yeah. No, everyone would have thought you got at least a 2-1, probably at first.
Yeah.
Oh, you've redeemed yourself with that 2-2 in our eyes.
Oh, no, I really did no work for a long time and then desperately tried to get it together over the last few weeks before exams.
Yeah.
That's the thing. Looking back, I sort of thought I had so much time. I could have done some work, done a lot of plays, and still got drunk quite often and fitted it in. But I was too useless a human at that point in my life. So, yeah.
Would it have been round about that time that you first saw Blackadder?
No, that would have been... I first saw Blackadder. It was in the mid-late 80s. I was in secondary school. I was about 13. And I think it was at the time the third series was starting to go out. And I remember somebody at school saying the first episode of the new series of Blackadder's on tonight. And I had heard of it, and then he said, oh, he's brilliant, you've got to see it. And I watched the third series, and then the third, then the second, then the first, then the fourth, and then watched them loads of times. I had them all, I videoed them all, because in those days, obviously, things were repeated quite often.
They were the days.
Yeah, and I managed to get them all on video. I think some of them, I've connected up our VHS video recorder to a friend of mine's VHS video recorder via some cables that he'd managed to acquire at some electrical shop and actually copied his video of some of it. And we had very, very low, at a very low quality VHS, and I watched it many, many times.
Looking back on when you first saw it...
Yeah.
What was it about it that attracted you, do you think?
It was funny. I mean, it was funny, and it was a long time before I realised it was a sitcom, because I associated sitcoms with being things like To the Man Are Born, and I remember a thing with, which I watched several episodes of, about two doctors. I think he had Nigel Havers in it, and he was a doctor.
And Tony Britton.
That's it. He was an NHS doctor, and Tony Britton was his father, a private doctor, and they both got divorced.
That's a pretty good pitch,
yeah,
isn't it?
And I remember watching that, but it was the odd attempt at humour, but it wasn't in any way that funny.
Yeah.
And then suddenly, so Blackadder felt like it was much more in the... you know, the Monty Python universe of it was being funny every second it could. Like, it's only here to be as funny as possible, yeah, and to take the piss out of things and undermine things and be rude and be nasty and be, you know, and this and that sort of relentless comedy felt like it's a totally different genre from the TV comedy that was largely on. Which, where the, you know, that didn't feel like, And I think for good reason, it didn't feel like as much effort had been put into making it funny.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hi, I'm taking time out of this excellent chat to tell you how passionate I am about making these history shows for you, and I think it's pretty obvious from my voice most of the time. So if you are enjoying the series, please do leave us a rating or review, and most importantly, please follow the series so you know when a new episode's dropped. This also helps to boost our place in the podcast charts. It is, as it were, some kind of, I'm searching for the words, cunning plan. And it ultimately means that we can make more and better episodes for you in the future. Thank you. Now where were we? It's so interesting, yeah. Actually, a word that you used there, which was, part of it was, to be nasty.
Yeah.
You're right. Even though a lot of people look at it with affection now, it was edgy, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was edgy. It was irreverent. I mean, fully irreverent. So what you have is the historical setting. So you're kind of saying, you know, everyone needs to be, you know, straightening their ties. This is the past and history and drama and all that. And then within that, the Mickey is relentlessly taken. And these people are, they talk in a modern way. They have modern, selfish, self-interested motivations. They're incompetent. They're idiots. And they're looking out for themselves. And that entirely is not the proper way either. Neither of the doctors in the Doctor sitcom were that nasty or that full on, and certainly no one in a historical drama would fail to be sort of on some level paying respect to the august nature of the past. And so all it was incredibly refreshing.
Except that all those things you've just described.
Yeah.
Is it too cruel of me to say that that was probably the culture of Oxford and Cambridge in the 70s and 80s?
Yes, it's the same. Same world, I suppose, isn't it?
Competitive, slightly bitter, but funny.
Yes.
Did you recognise that it was part of a tradition going back to That Was the Week That Was? And
I don't think when I first saw it, I didn't. I think because I was, despite my behaviour at university, interested in history, I naturally pieced together my sense of the story of British comedy over the following years as I got more into comedy and worked out the connections. And obviously the number of people who'd come from Oxford and Cambridge was something I noted. And that was, as a SWAT, that was great news, because those were places of academic respectability and also where the comedy was coming from. So you don't have to make a difficult choice. You know, you can say, I'm just going to go there, work hard and become a lawyer. But actually, no, that's the place where you can entirely piss away your days trying to write jokes. And so that was great.
Do you think that there was a little part of you when you were 16 or 17 that was thinking that, I want to go to Oxford and Cambridge, I want to be very serious, but I can be in showbiz as well at the same time?
Yeah. I desperately wanted to be a comedian, but I don't think I would have said that openly until I was a student, because that, you know, I on some level I knew my audience and I knew that wouldn't have gone down well. That was not what the people at school or my parents wanted to hear. Obviously anyone announcing they're going to go into show business, they're probably going to fail. And so if you love them or you care about them at all, what you need to do is to get them away from that idea. And I totally understand that the the statistical basis for the discouragement that I would have received if I'd announced to the 16-year-old that I wanted to become a comedian.
Yes, you and I are both very lucky boys, aren't we?
Yeah, absolutely, yeah, yeah.
We should be looking behind us all the time to make sure that fate isn't going to take it all away from us.
Yeah, definitely.
It's only it hasn't taken it away from Rowan. That was a very good link, did you know?
Yeah, so yeah, yeah.
Do you think you got how extraordinary he was from fairly early on?
Yes, I think he is. His performance was sort of magnetic and being drawn. You were just hanging on the next funny, nasty thing he was going to say.
Yeah,
and that the sort of it was just sort of incredibly watchable and likable, even though it was nasty. And I think that's the, you know, the addictive cocktail of it, the fact that this is a villainous character who you love. And a lot of obviously the writing is key to that, but also is having a presence and a persona that is able to be that likable while being that unpleasant.
It is quite an extraordinary persona, isn't it? In a way, it's very unlike what most performers were doing at that time. To me, it almost goes back to the musical, Max Wall and clowns and things like that, all this kind of wonderful business he does.
There's a bit in Blackadder 3 when the prince is trying to persuade him to do something, and he's basically saying, no, I won't. And I remember him, he's being bribed, being offered more money, an extra £100 a month or whatever. And I remember him standing there and going and looking at his fingernails as a signal of, I'm not interested. Yeah. Just going, like that. And I remember particularly noticing and thinking almost in despair, how the hell did he think to do that?
Yeah.
That's so funny. It's a thing he's chosen to do with his hand, and it totally conveys, but it gets a laugh like it's some words. And it was the perfect gesture of contemptuous nonchalance.
You can imagine what it was like in rehearsals with him, because he would do four or five of those things a day, three of which wouldn't work, and he'd just go... It's like he'd throw his hand away because the business wasn't good enough.
Right,
and then he'd do another two, and we'd all go, oh.
Yeah. Well, it was such a small gesture, but I remember it so clearly. And genuinely, I laughed at it, but genuinely made me unhappy, because I thought, I want to do this, and I'd never have thought of that. For me, it had echoes of Basil Fawlty.
Ah.
And very different performers, that same sort of angry, nasty, watchable man in the middle trying to cover his own back and absolutely pulling no punches, not in any way trying to get the audience's sympathy and being all the more sympathetic for that. I felt that through line. I felt that influence of the John Cleese, you know, broken authority figure.
Well, you're absolutely right. They wore 40 towers on their shoulders like John Bunyan's pack going through the valley of the shadow of death. No, that's slightly over-exaggerating, but you know what I mean. I mean, I think they always refer to it. I mean, I know that you're a big fan of Blackadder. We, quite frankly, we wouldn't have invited you here today if you hadn't been. But do you think somewhere deep down in you, in the comedy that you do, it has been influenced by having watched Blackadder?
Yes, I think so. I think I think obviously you can't tell what you're influenced by, but what I know is that the rhythms of the dialogue in Blackadder, as I watched it over and over again, there would definitely have been a time I could have recited it, and I could have recited it, as it were, in the right rhythm. You know, the rhythms of the lines written to elicit a studio audience laugh, which is different from how you write lines in a single camera thing, and the delivery, the laugh, the next line, the theatrical timing, it was incredibly beguiling. And that definitely was somewhere in my head when I first tried to write a sketch or a scene or whatever. It should be like that. It should be to that tune. And if you haven't said anything that might elicit an audience laugh in the last couple of lines, then you're wasting people's time. So yes, it must have influenced me.
You're listening to Tony Robinson's Cunning Cast with me, Tony Robinson. And today I'm interviewing Blackadder superfan, the comedian, David Mitchell. When you and Robert Webb left university, was the idea that you would kind of stick together and write sketches and perform them?
Yes, and absolutely. We decided we were going to go for it and be a double act and do shows in Edinburgh and that sort of thing. And you know, we didn't know if that would work out or how to approach it. And we did our best writing letters to agents and that sort of thing. But that was our plan for the... We would have had to have failed for a lot longer than we did before we'd have given up.
How long did you fail for?
Solid, total failure for a year, partial failure for a second year, and then we started in the third year out of university, we started to make a living.
How? What happened? Who became interested in you?
We got an agent after about a year, and then we started to have cups of tea with people who genuinely had jobs. The key work that started to pay the rent was we got commissioned to write on Armstrong and Miller's Channel 4 sketch show by the producer Phil Clark, who we'd met at the BBC, where he was making a very, very cheap show called Comedy Nation. And he was, you know, he was trawling for, you know, anyone who's trying to do sketches at all come in. And we met him through that, and then he liked our stuff and got us into write when he was then producing a show where they were actually paying the writers a noticeable amount of money.
Comedy Nation is a great title. As someone passionate in archaeology, it's a dating title. You know precisely when that would have gone out on the television.
And it was absolutely, loads of people were brought into that. And so, but at the same time, it had no budget, and it was therefore... It was essentially the sort of thing that people would now just do on their phones, but before that they had the phones.
Yeah.
There was no higher production values than that. You had to bring in your own props, and for a show that was to be broadcast on BBC Two. So it was... And as a result, you know, it had a lot of very good people in it, and yet was dreadful. It was really not good.
Can you remember who else was in it?
I'm pretty sure Peter Serafinowicz was in it. I'm pretty sure... Certainly, Ricky Gervais and Stephen Merchant had some involvement with it. Well, I didn't meet them then, but I think... And we never met anyone else who was in it, because you would just go in. And most of the first sketches we did for it, we filmed in an office in Television Centre, because Phil Clark had said to the people, "Why do you fancy taking a long lunch?"
So it might actually have been in this room.
Yes. And it was so cheap. But it was, you know, actually getting on television, and one week they didn't broadcast it because the room where the tape was locked, and the person with the key was ill, and so we were all there, you know, it was something like it was a late at night on some day of the week, and we were sitting up to watch the episode that might have our sketch in, and it just didn't come on, and they put on something else. And it was, you know, so... Yeah.
After Armstrong and Miller, how long was it before you two got your first show?
About a year. We did Armstrong and Miller, and then we were writing on the Jack Doherty show, which was a chat show on Channel 5. And then we got involved in a slightly higher budget than Comedy Nation sketch show for BBC Two called Bruiser. And that was like a group, and we did a pilot of that I wasn't in, but Rob was. And then they commissioned a series of that. And that was on TV about 3 years later in the end. But that was the sort of focus of our lives, was that. And that, you know, that was very exciting, but we totally sunk without trace. But that was properly shooting a sketch show and was very exciting and had the odd sketch in it that I still think was worth watching. So that's on TV about 3.5 years after university. And then a year or two after that was when we were shooting Peep Show. So that was our sort of trajectory.
Tell me about Peep Show, because it's one of those shows where you look at the people who are involved in it and they've all gone on to have stellar careers, or at least that's how it appears. Mm. Were you just kind of cast, or were you always going to do it from the very beginning?
Sam Bain and Jesse Armstrong, who wrote it, we had met on a BBC team writing project that was ridiculous, where they'd commissioned one script and then the money was to be shared between eight people who would team write it. And we absolutely produced a script that was less than the sum of its parts. But we'd met them on that and got on. And so we then... there's so much torturous development and failure, and that, you know, we then wrote a thing for the BBC just where they commissioned two scripts and we co-wrote them with them, and then that wasn't commissioned, and then they pitched to Channel 4 this idea of a show where you're looking through people's eyes, and then they asked if we wanted to be those people because they had no desire to perform themselves. And I remember the first meeting with the guy that produced that, Andrew O'Connor, who was who'd been a magician and an impressionist and on-screen person himself a decade earlier. And it just felt like the least likely of all of our various plates spinning and then crashing, seemed like the least likely to come to anything. And then that, you know, and then that worked out.
How long had it been running before you thought, blimey, actually, this is the one that's not going to come crashing down?
When we got a second series of it, that was already so much more successful than
anything
we'd
you'd
done
ever
before.
Done, yeah.
We thought, well, whatever, this is, you know, to get a second series, that means the first series wasn't an irredeemable failure. Yeah. So this has been great. But they never, we were never comfortable, as it were. They never said, oh, great, make this as long as you like. There was like the third series... you know, came, they commissioned that slowly and grudgingly, and then they nearly axed it after that, and then they got a fourth suit, you know, and even when we were in the running for awards, it was always a marginal recommission until we got to about series five, and then I think we were a bit comfortable then for the rest of it.
Was Olivia Colman in it from the beginning?
Yes, she was in the, Rob and I knew her from university, and in fact, Peep Show was piloted, it was called POV then, it was piloted in two halves, in a very, very, we had a very small amount of money from Channel 4 to make a sort of 12-minute taster. And I remember Jesse saying to me and Rob, and do you think your friend from university would still be okay to come in and play the woman in the office? And that, you know, that was how the, and yeah, I think she's still free, I'll just check. And that was the basic, that was how the deal was done. And, you know, none of us, and it was just literally, it was just a Saturday in an office and she was there and shot her scene. And then obviously she was brilliant, as we knew, we already knew she would be. And so when Channel 4 then commissioned a second 12 minutes, we had to finish the pilot 6 months later. In a flat which had done up its own kitchen with the location money that we paid for the first half. So that continued, they had to shoot it all one way. Then when Channel 4 said, OK, we'll make a series of this, they quite rightly said, and can she definitely be in it?
OK, so you knew that Olivia was brilliant then. Mm. Did you have any hint that Jesse Armstrong was a bit special in those days, than just another writer, as it were?
I think, yeah, both Sam and Jesse were immediately very, very funny people to be around. And that was the first, we just got on with them. They felt like they were on a comic wavelength that we were really attracted to. Yeah. And every script everything they wrote when we were writing with them was always, you know, funny, and we liked it. The first script, with the pilot script of POV, again, it was just immediately really good and funny and different and angsty in an attractive way. And I think that's, for all that we were worried about whether Peep Show would work because of the weird filming style and the fact that it's not just a normal programme like the other ones, and we're on some level slightly wishing we could be making it more normally, the scripts were just always a joy. And you could sort of see in Sam and Jesse, a bit like what you were saying about the characters came from them. There was a side of themselves that they were reflecting in the script. So I think we felt very lucky to have met them and to be collaborating with them. But also just enjoying their company. And I think that's a huge attraction in comedy, is you get to hang out with people who are funny and entertaining, and you know, and good people to spend time with while they're moving all the lights. Yeah.
Can you see any of your experience in Peep Show in Succession, which those people went on to create?
There are lines in Succession that for me feel Peep Show-ish, but I'm obviously looking for that. And
yeah.
You know, and I know, you know, and Jesse had been fascinated by the Murdochs for a long time and had been thinking of different ways of developing something about that kind of world. So I can feel his presence within it very strong way. And what I think is makes it so, you know, I imagine one of the reasons it's so entertaining and successful is that it's, you've got the grandeur of a big drama about something big and important, and then within it all sorts of weird, twisted, small, contemptible, Peep Show level human things.
And indeed Blackadder-y in that same way. Yeah.
And it's just, exactly. It's just so, it's very, very Blackadder-y in that Blackadder, it takes, say, the Elizabethan age.
Yeah.
We're supposed to, you know, somehow English heritage has told us to be very serious about these people and their portraits and go, no, they were just twats.
Yeah.
Twats like people are now in mad clothes and stupid buildings. And the worst of them were the ones that believed their own hype. And
yeah,
that, you know, and that's absolutely in Succession, and it's, I suppose that's the Edmund Blackadder character is the one that sort of shines out because on some level he seems to realise the idiocy of it all, and that they're all just sort of stupid, worthless, self-serving people telling themselves that they're kings and lords and the like, and it's all nonsense.
You've just illuminated something for me. People often say to me, if you did another Blackadder, where would it be set?
Yeah.
What I ought to be saying is, we don't need to because Brian Cox is already playing him.
Yeah. Or, you know, Boris Johnson.
Indeed.
I mean, imagine the chaotic number 10 of Boris Johnson.
Absolutely. Going back to Succession, one of the things that strike me about it is that the music is kind of huge in it.
Yeah.
The music is like the frame around some great Renaissance painting, brilliantly written. And I think, in a similar way, what Howard Goodall did for Blackadder is not dissimilar.
As soon as you think of Blackadder, you hear the signature tune. It's a great piece of music, but it's also sort of amazing branding. And you get drawn into the mood of, and I think that sets it up, doesn't it? The mood of the past, the sort of slightly delicate nature of here we are in the past, and then suddenly the jokes and the nastiness and the characters are kind of smashing out of that sort of, about the musical vase that's been set up at the beginning.
But it's also slightly overblown, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's da-da, da-da-da-da-da-da.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes,
Serious, but my God, it's ridiculous.
Yeah.
Maybe it's a reflection of how we are as a nation.
Yeah.
When you'd done Peep Show, did you go back to writing sketches or did you shift to sitcoms? What were you looking towards as a writer at that time?
Rob and I were doing, at the same time as Peep Show started, basically, we got our Radio 4 sketch show started. So we were, through all the early years of Peep Show, or most of the years of Peep Show, either making a radio sketch show or then a BBC Two sketch show alongside it. And so, yeah, writing sketches was really our focus more than, because apart from anything else, because Sam and Jesse wrote such great sitcom scripts for Peep Show, Rob and I were content to write sketches instead because we were slightly intimidated by that. And yes, we've had various goes at writing a sitcom, but we grew up with Blackadder and with Fawlty Towers, and then we got to be in Peep Show. And none of that makes the idea of writing a sitcom seem easy. It has given me huge respect for it as I'd say television's greatest genre, and the only genre that addresses the fact that in people's lives don't usually change. And that's the thing. Well, everything else, films, novels, all about bloody change. I mean, changes in people's lives. And when you ask people what the main issue they're facing is, and it's not usually change. It's the fact that things stay the same. People live in ruts. And sitcom is the art form that addresses the rut. And it works so brilliantly on television. Anyway, for all of those reasons, we thought, well, we'll stick to sketches. You go in, tell a few jokes and get out before it's boring, because we're intimidated by all this.
And when people say that change is central to their lives, they usually mean they're being made redundant.
Yeah.
And they're still going to say, stay in exactly the same rut,
yes,
but without a job.
Yeah, and obviously there are changes, obviously, in people's lives, but that those changes aren't always a good story. Finding something that addresses and in a way that, you know, and there's the thing about, you know, about the great sitcoms and about, you know, Blackadder is so strong in this, that it's also, things it addresses are disappointment and people letting themselves down and not elevating themselves out of the rut they're in or out of the failings they've been guilty of in the past. And those are really difficult, nasty, unhappy things about humanity, and to make entertainment out of that is magical.
I suppose that's what my catchphrase is all about, isn't it?
Yeah.
The moment I say I have a cunning plan, you know that only disaster lies ahead.
Yeah.
The world will not change because of that plan. If anything, it'll be slightly worse.
Yeah, well, yeah, there's that little moment of aspiration, of hope. And you're sort of looking down on it and knowing it's doomed.
Yeah.
But at the same time, it makes all of the failed cunning plans in the lives of all of the people watching it easier to bear.
Hi, this is Tony Robinson bringing you my cunning cast. If you're enjoying this podcast, please leave us a rating or a review. And do take a look at our back catalogue. There's a growing selection of shows there to keep you company. Everything from Stonehenge to Why Pies Were Invented, Why Do Our Dogs Love Us So Much, and the legend that is Miriam Margolyes. I'm sure you're going to find something you like, so why not take a lucky dip? Go on, it won't hurt you. Did you know Ben Elton before Upstart Crow?
No. I'd briefly met him on a previous reboot of, I think it was of Saturday Live. It was Rob and I did a sketch and we met him, and it was, you know, nice to have met him, but I didn't know him then. And then I next met him for when I had a lunch with him and Gareth Edwards, who produced Upstart Crow, discussing whether I'd be interested. And Ben's opening gambit was, I think you need to shave your hair off and then put a wig on there. And I immediately was put in the position where I had to immediately go, I'm not going to shave my hair off because it might well fall out anyway. So I'm going to keep it there while I've got it, and we can put a bald cap on. But yes, so I got to know him then, and it's been brilliant to get to know him. Growing up watching Blackadder.
This is very interesting. It's the first time you've struggled to reply.
Well, no,
and it's all about Ben.
Yeah, genuinely, but I didn't know, having met Rob and Olivia Colman, I didn't know I was going to meet someone else. I'd feel that, and Sam and Jesse, of course. I thought the time where I'm meeting the people who are going to be like important collaborators in my life is over.
Yeah.
And I never dreamt that I would feel that comically close to anyone else, let alone it would be Ben Elton, someone I sort of grew up admiring and watching the work of. So it's a really happy thing for me to have met him and worked with him, and to find him sort of even more creative and fun and impressive than I'd expected. He's a genius, I think. And, you know, I was so lucky to be in Peep Show, but then Ben Elton wrote essentially as close a show to Blackadder as you can imagine happening in the 21st century for me to play Shakespeare in. I mean, I certainly do not deserve a lottery win after that. I am out of luck. Because that was sort of brilliantly fortunate. And I, obviously, watching Blackadder, you sort of, that's what I want to do as a job. I want to be on sets like that, with people laughing, with scripts full of gags. But I knew even then, well, unfortunately, this show isn't going to run until I'm old enough to be in it. And then Ben writes Upstart Crow, which is, as you know, as close to the same genre as you can be, and with, you know, his brilliant inventive jokes, and a character I could play, which, you know.
Yes, because in a way, Shakespeare is the antithesis of Blackadder, isn't he? He doesn't have that grand malevolence.
No, he's a much, in many ways, a much more, in Upstart Crow, a much more traditional sitcom character. He's put upon and fearful and tentatively ambitious. And that's, you know, and to see that side of someone who is just presented to us as a genius who could never have been assailed or bettered, to see that humanity within him, you know, is a great character insight and a great way of humanising a genius. And for me, entirely plausible. I imagine he will have felt like that. Why wouldn't he? We know the circumstances of his life, and it's a weird thing, I always think, for Britain as a culture, that Shakespeare made a good amount of money. I genuinely think it's problematic for us, because artistic geniuses are supposed to die in penury. Second to that, they're supposed to be hailed as mega heroes. But what Shakespeare did was turn a tidy profit. And it's so shopkeepery, you know. And he was probably the greatest genius that ever lived. But what he did is he made a good living out of it. And I think that fact alone might be partly responsible for the rise of Thatcher.
Were you besotted by Shakespeare before you came upon him again via Ben?
No, I was a big admirer of Shakespeare, but I think, like most people, I'd also sat through many Shakespearean productions that perhaps didn't give his work the best airing. And also, I was like confronting the fact that it doesn't all last. You know, some bits of Shakespeare, it is impossible to make them as entertaining as they will have been then. And I struggle with that, because you want, particularly if you're someone who writes stuff yourself, you want to think that a joke can last forever.
Yeah.
Well, Shakespeare couldn't make them last forever. Some of them last forever.
If he can't, we certainly can't.
Exactly. And so it's, in a way, when Shakespeare has dated, it's a sort of sad denial of the immortality of works. And it's the sad stuff that stood the test of time better. So for all that, I certainly wouldn't say, let's just put on a production of King John, because I can't imagine a more fun way to spend an evening. I was sort of convinced of his genius and sort of, I suppose, slightly nationally proud of that. Yeah. But in playing him, it made me feel weirdly close to this person who struggled and succeeded and had a sort of spark within him that was amazing, and he must have been admired at the time, but nobody would have got it about quite, you know, what they had in their hands. It's definitely I feel more closer, fonder, and more admiring of him for having essentially
given you work.
given me work, and I've portrayed him as a mediocre loser in lots of ways, but still.
Can I flip you back to being a nerdy 16 and a half year old?
Yeah.
If you were asked to write the essay about the differences and similarities between Upstart Crow and Blackadder, where would you start?
I think I would start by saying that I think Blackadder is the nastier show. And I mean that in a positive way, that it's the show that's more about weakness and bitterness and the more lamentable sides of the human character. And Edmund Blackadder absolutely sort of personifies that. He is clever, but he is not nice and not kind and doesn't care. And that's and it's so. You know, it's very funny seeing that unashamedly presented and being encouraged to root for him. It's just the funniest of all anti-heroes. you know, you really want him to triumph, even though that would not be good for the world. And, you know, and it, but it, it's leavened by the fact that the people around him are so stupid or incompetent or vain. Whereas I think in Upstart Crow, it's a more kindly universe. It doesn't sort of punch through in the sort of nasty, gleeful way that Blackadder certainly did to me as a teenager. But at the same time, I think Ben, at a later stage of his career, he wanted to have more. There is more family warmth and human feeling in Upstart Crow than there's probably room for in Blackadder. That's just, you know, it's sort of action-packed and gag-packed, but it's relentlessly nasty. It's a very hard-edged comedy, really.
Let me ask you one last gossipy question. Yeah. And you can say, I'm not interested in talking about this if you don't want to. Of course you can. Did you meet Victoria through work? Was she another of these sort of bright, dazzling young women on the telly that you came across?
I met Victoria at a party. It was a party after a film premiere. So it's quite glamorous. And I had never been to a party after a film premiere before. And she had come to the party, but hadn't actually been able to go to the film. So that's where I met her. I was only at that because of work, and, you know, so in a way it's through work, but it was also different.
And did she dazzle you with chat?
She did. Yeah. No, she was. She dazzled me with chat. I was immediately smitten. It was a party I'm very glad I went to. And, you know, there aren't many parties you say that about, because they can be grueling. But that was the right call.
We all are glad that you went to that party. Thanks ever so much, David.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening. If you want to watch the documentary Blackadder, The Lost Pilot, it's available to catch up on Sky, Virgin and Now.
If you want to join in the conversation, you can find me on X at Tony Robinson, and you can follow all our podcast news on X and Instagram at CunningCastPod. And please don't forget to follow this podcast so you don't miss a single episode. Tony Robinson's CunningCast is produced by the wonderful Melissa Fitzgerald and is a Zinc Media production.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.